Today on Movie World, as we continue our coverage from the Tribeca Film Festival of New York 2018. It's time for Movie Wallace. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And here's Dee as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly list of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you.
And boy, we have loved movies.
We have. We've gorged on them. We're sitting here, I guess, on... Well, we're kind of done with the film festival. We're going to do two more podcasts, this one included, to kind of go over the movies we covered. But we've gorged again.
Yes, and we are positively sated.
We're waddling. Yes. We're the equivalent of waddling.
I'm belching.
Belching
loosening,
movies.
Loosening our belts.
Yes. But today we are going to cover the day three films.
We are covering day three.
Yes, so I guess we should cut the banter because there are so many movies to talk about. We're going to try and cover, I think, six in this podcast. And we've all been... really square-eyed, getting the most out of Tribeca, as I think one should when one comes to a film festival. If you are in town, you should have gorged because the film festival has finished.
Yeah.
But
and we have our favorite eating spots already. We always have them.
Yeah. And then on our way back, we found more, but we'll talk about that later.
Yes.
Steak frites.
Yes.
And about six on the way back.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's jump straight into the reviews then, or discussions rather. We didn't really do formal reviews of these film festival movies. We kind of just talk about them and hopefully you'll gain insight for them if they should ever be released in any other format or at other film festivals.
And so, some of them have got release dates. Some of these movies are getting a general mm-hmm. release, and we'll try and update that on the show as and when they come about.
Terrific. All right, first movie that we're going to talk about today then is The Feeling of Being Watched. And Rashmi, you will tell us about that.
I will. So this was one of the movies that fell under the category of viewpoints. Journalist Asia Bundawi sets out to investigate long-brewing rumors that her quiet, predominantly Arab-American neighborhood was being monitored by the FBI. And in the process, she exposes a surveillance program on a scale no one could have imagined. So, Yazdi, why don't you start us off on what you thought of this one?
Yeah, this is an interesting film. It's very, very topical, and it speaks to a very hot-button topic right now, which is... the extra surveillance, if you will, that happens with Muslim Americans. The writer-director of this documentary essentially finds out that her home and her whole community, where predominantly Islamic Americans lived, were actually being monitored even prior to 9/11. And the entire movie goes about... documenting her efforts to try and understand it. Under the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI is supposed to release information related to any kind of visits they have made, any kind of interviews they've done, and her difficulties with trying to get any information around it. And then it opens up to larger issues about surveillance in general. So I wouldn't go as far as saying as it's an essential film, but it's one which is very eye-opening.
Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is essential, mainly from the viewpoint of, you know, it begs the question, you know, what kind of society do we want, right? There are certain rights afforded to American citizens. And in this case, I think, you know, the Muslim community in particular probably consists of American and non-American citizens. But, you know, assuming that for the most part, the people in this documentary were American citizens, it was very surprising to me, given you know, the constitutional learning that I'm kind of doing right now, the amount of surveillance that seemed to be bestowed upon this community, or imposed rather than bestowed, imposed upon this community. So I thought it was fascinating watching. You know, the what's the name of the journalist that
Asia Bundawi.
she did a really nice job of kind of pulling together the various pieces to tell a story. And again, it was just kind of very eye-opening to me to kind of understand, you know, the perhaps the movie's point is that there was an overreach by law enforcement by going into these communities, because ultimately they weren't able to find substantial evidence of any kind of terrorist wrongdoing. They were able to find some, you know, white collar crimes, and I think if you observe many people for enough, you'll find that. But again, our constitution here in the United States doesn't cover that. So I thought it was fascinating watching. I think it was you know, well constructed. It left me with some level of faith that the court systems do uphold the constitution, that ultimately there can be you know, the right things prevail. But I thought this was terrific, eye-opening, and frightening.
I agree with you. Well-constructed, smartly made documentary about what it feels like to be of a certain group of people who are constantly under scrutiny. It's happened many times throughout the history of the US, so I thought that was very interesting. And I think what it does very well is it kind of builds on this concept of one bad apple, right? So there's one bad apple, and now the agencies in the US feel like that's pervasive throughout the entire community. And what I found interesting was that those very agencies that are there to keep us safe actually make these people feel not free and not safe. And I think that Asia Bandawi did a fantastic job of really going deep into people's families in that community, which is very tight-knit, and showing us what it feels like to be constantly under a magnifying glass. And this whole concept of, is it the agency that creates the paranoia that then isolates the community, or is it that the community isolates itself as a result? So it was this whole chicken and egg argument, which mm-hmm. I thought was fascinating, and I'd never thought of it that way. That being said, just the documentary itself, she herself, I think, is a very charming main protagonist, and ultimately becomes part of the story. You know, we heard a lot, Joe, and we'll talk about The Fourth Estate, which is another journalism movie that we got to watch at the end of the day. But it's this whole concept of the role of a journalist is to report the news, not be part of the news. And I thought there was a nice twist that came in this documentary where she becomes part of the story. So I loved this documentary. Great, great viewing.
Yeah, I mean, she definitely has the most calming presence, both in terms of how she speaks as well as her physical presence, which goes a long ways. And I think it comes from her previous experience with being on public radio. And, you know, she just is a very reliable,
thoughtful,
you know, thoughtful,
very
reliable.
Thoughtful,
and, you
yeah,
know,
measured.
This is a very enraging topic. And she always, through the entire movie, keeps her cool. I mean, her mom is quite a spitfire.
Very sassy.
Very sassy. But, you know, she always maintains her cool. And then two other things. I think the movie also, for me at least, made a really good point about the double standards. And, you know, of late there's been a lot of talk about white privilege and so forth. But she particularly talks about a neighbor who was suspected of funding some of the terrorism activities.
Pre-9/11. This is like back in the days of Hamas. Yeah.
Like, you know, the more fundamentalist Islamic efforts. And then he goes through a proper trial and, mm-hmm. you know, he is completely exonerated. I mean, after he goes to the trial, they don't find any evidence that he was, you know, he was in any way involved. And yet, by virtue of the fact that he is a Muslim American who was charged for being a terrorist, that label sticks with him for the rest of his life. And, you know, the kind of the unfairness of that particular situation. The only thing I didn't care for too much about the movie, and it's a minor gripe, is that the movie kind of overuses the discordant music and then the scratchy visuals and this pounding music score. You know, even when she's opening an envelope, there's this pounding music score. And I know that you want to dramatize what's happening, but you don't want to be guilty of the one thing you're trying to fight against. She's trying to fight against paranoia. And by making a movie whose own devices kind of seem to be invoking fear and paranoia seemed not fair to me. But that's a minor gripe.
No, that's a fair point. I mean, I did find myself having that sense of dread and fear. And it was interesting. I was thinking as we were watching the movie that this is kind of a minefield to talk about, given that a podcast goes out on the internet and stays there indelibly. My mind started going to some, you know, strange places, you know, in terms of, you know, how will this permanent record, you know, come back to haunt me in some way, you know, in terms of how the words can be twisted here. But again, you know, I think, you know, the movie, you know, fulfills its purpose of opening our eyes and essentially giving us that debate that we need to have constantly, which is it okay to profile people? Is it okay to be suspicious? You know, are we a truly innocent until proven guilty as the Constitution supports here in the United States? You know, we've got to keep asking ourselves these questions. And I think the movie helped me kind of get back into that mindset of, you know, this is the way it should be. And this is the society that we strive for here.
Yeah. And I think one thing that really impressed me also was that, A, this is a woman writer director. And then secondly, you know, she really galvanizes the other women in the community. And I was impressed at how they were able to make these men in a normally very patriarchal society sit up and listen as they were educating their entire community about how they can help themselves, complete with slogans like, you know, no chai for the FBI, which made me hysterically laugh. Great documentary.
Okay, let's move on then to our second movie of the day, which was Studio 54. And Yazdi, you're going to give us that.
Studio 54, gosh, who doesn't know about Studio 54? It's impossible to recall late 70s New York without recalling Studio 54. So go the festival notes for this particular documentary. It was the legendary Manhattan night spot where celebrities, think Liza, Liz, Mick, Farrah, and Andy, socialites, the straight, the queer, and the beautiful danced, drank, perhaps got high, and most importantly, got seen. Located at a then seedy part of town, it was the brainchild of Ian Schrager and Steve Rebell, two Brooklyn college buddy entrepreneurs who, over the course of 33 months, became the kings of New York and then lost it all. There was a famous movie, 54, a fictionalized version, which came out a while ago, which, you know, spoke about the friendship of these two individuals. So here is director Matt Tiranor, who skillfully tells this one-of-a-kind story using never-before-seen footage, period music, present-day commentary by Schrager, and recollections from regulars and staff. So Rashmi, I think you were the only one who saw this. Tell us, is there more to be learned about Studio 54?
I'll say it from the outset. You know, you come to a film festival and you find that one film that really resonates with you and you feel so happy that you found that one little nugget. Here's my favorite movie of the festival, hands down. So recall, Joe, you and I always have this conversation, and we have it with a lot of people, I think, that we meet, which is, you know, if you could never fail at anything, or what would be your fantasy job? And as I've always said to some people, I don't know if this is well known, I would be a club DJ. That would be my secret job that I would do. And so I'm fascinated by Studio 54, and I've lapped up many documentaries that have come up in the past about the 70s and the 80s. And of course, like you said, Yazdi, Studio 54 always comes up. This isn't the documentary about Studio 54 per se. This is the documentary about two boys from Brooklyn who are friends and ultimately live out their dream, and how they live out their dream, and the mistakes they make, and the price they pay for making those mistakes. And of course, it has loud disco music, and I bopped in my seat. But most importantly, this documentary, which is a weird thing to say that it's about disco, this movie got under my skin, and literally by the end of it, I was crying. I was literally sobbing, because I think the one regret I always had, and I grew up with disco music in my house. My sister was an avid disco dancer, and we would literally put, you know, what they called 7-inch vinyl on the stereo, and we would dance all in the evening. We would dance to disco music, we would make up dances, and we would admire the clothing and love the fashion. And I think one of my biggest regrets in life is I wish that I had gone to Studio 54.
Well, you weren't old enough.
I wasn't old enough, exactly. But I think, you know, it's one of those, if you could go
back,
if
in
you
time.
Could travel, time travel, I would love to have gone live to Studio 54. So this is a really well-constructed documentary. It really goes deep into how everything happened. It's actually the first documentary that Ian Schrager has spoken on. So it's actually taken him 40 years to be in a place where he doesn't feel so pained that he can actually talk about this. And again, I think I can't say enough how this is really about the synergy that two people create and a magic and a moment that they create. And again, I think the thing that was making me sob the most was, gosh, I have this loss. You know, it was such a moment in time. It was such a lightning rod for a moment in time. And it only lasted 33 months. But my God, it's made such an impact on history.
It's in cultural a sense. Influence. I mean, yeah. when you think of disco, it is synonymous with exactly. Studio 54.
Exactly. And which came first, kind of, you know, disco music propagated to Studio 54 or Studio 54 propagated disco music, makes an appearance in the Chic song, La Freak.
I'm actually mm-hmm. blown away that it really did only have a 33-month legacy.
I know.
I thought it influenced, suggested it was around for decades.
No, it was 33 months. Wow. That was one of the most shocking things for me. And so then you're kind of thinking about, God, I wish I'd gone to Studio 54. And then I realized that, you know, Joe, we've been lucky enough to visit some of these nice hotels around the world, like the Delano and the Thompson and the Kim, you know, a lot of these Kimpton hotels. They're all Ian Schrager hotels. Mm. So Ian Schrager is this incredible individual who, after Studio 54, all of that went away, reinvented himself as a hotelier. And he's a very successful hotelier. And another thing that was, I was like, oh my God, that's that same Ian Schrager. I didn't ever make that connection. So, you know, they did their time, but they managed to decrease their time. They got put away in jail. And the interesting thing was that in 2015, I believe, President Obama actually pardoned Ian Schrager.
Hmm. Wow.
Fascinating. Best documentary ever. Loved it.
Not ever.
Well, of Tribeca, my favorite of Tribeca.
2018.
Yeah. 2018.
Yes, yes.
Fantastic. I mean, if this comes out, I will be recommending this to everyone.
Terrific.
Yeah. I mean, fantastic music. There's this one scene that I have to share with you, which is they literally recreate the feeling of as the doors opened, you can hear the disco music down the hall. And so there's this like deep bass thud. That's playing in the background. Like it kind of anticipates you going into the main narrative of the movie as the doors of studio, you know, as you would have been waiting outside, and as the doors would open, you would hear it down the corridor. So amazing. Great documentary.
And the notes here in the Tribeca Guide do suggest a connection with A&E. So hopefully this is something that will make its way onto network television. Terrific. Okay, let's move on then. Movie number three of the week, or of the day rather, gosh, is The Elephant and the Butterfly.
Yeah, so, now this was one that I really wanted to watch, but I think I was in Studio 54 as the two of you were watching this one. So bear with me as I get the notes. Okay, so The Elephant and the Butterfly. This is a French movie, and this basically says, when the doorbell rings one summer afternoon, Camille, a single mother and architect, answers it, expecting the babysitter for her 5-year-old daughter, Elsa, and then instead on the doorstep appears Antoine, Camille's former partner and Elsa's father, who Camille has not seen in 5 years, and who Elsa does not even know. But when the babysitter fails to materialize, Camille has no choice but to leave her daughter with the girl's estranged father, releasing the pair on a 3-day adventure that thrusts an ill-prepared Antoine abruptly into parenthood. So this is directed by Emily Van Elmt and screenwriter also Emily Van Elmt. And again, one that I really wanted to watch. So Yazdi, what did you think of this one?
So first of all,
what a cute title too.
What a great title. First of all, again, this is, I think, 46-47% of the movies that were shown at Tribeca Film Festival were directed by women, and scores more were written and directed by women. So this is another one of those. What do I say about this movie? It has a really nice natural rhythm about it, which is difficult to do when you have a plot which is very, very sitcom-y. I mean, and by the way, those notes have a big, big spoiler in them. But anyway, we'll let that pass. But the premise of the movie is very sitcom-y, right? This mom, single mom, and her child are together and she has to go off on a business trip and her care, you know, the nanny doesn't arrive and her ex-husband arrives to meet her and she has no choice but to leave her daughter with this person. So, and you know, it's about how the, you know, how everything happens. But this movie is shot with so much confidence, such a natural flair. It's not a surreal movie. It's at all times, it's very, very grounded in deep reality. Mm-hmm. But there is an abundance of goodwill. There's an abundance of sunshine. There's an abundance of a belief that people will be decent. And, you know, at the end of the day, you don't need a movie to be profound. You don't need it to be, you know, to have a big message. You just need it to be good company. And this movie is most excellent company. I loved it.
Joe.
Yeah, Yazdi, you drew my attention to the Roger Ebert quote, which is, it's not what something is about, it's how it's about what it's about.
And exactly.
That line, that quote is so apt when you talk about this movie, because on the face of it, there's not a lot to this story. It takes place over a couple of days, but I spent those 2 days with these characters and I felt, you know, my overall sentiment was that this was just a delightful way to spend, you know, an hour and a half. And it was a delightful way for them to spend a couple of days together, because they're, you know, it's about the building of a relationship that is non-existent, or at least apparently non-existent at the beginning of the movie. And by the end of the movie, you know, that there's something there that wasn't there before, right? Sounds like, I think that's Beauty and the Beast. But they're but it really is about please, no singing recipes.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh God, we gave Yazdi some wine today and look at the result. But no, it's a stunning little movie that just had me it's just filled with beauty. And I think there's something very, very feminine about the way that the movie is directed. And I say that in the sense of, there's a little girl, and this movie is, you know, it's kind of make or break with the casting of this little girl.
Yeah.
And she's terrific. But there's a very motherly way that the camera looks and views this little girl. I think it's something, you know, it's often down at the level of her. It views her with this kind of little, this beauty that kind of shows through. I don't know how they cast it, whether it was written that way, whether it was shot that way, whether the little girl was directed that way. But you feel it, and you feel it all the way through the movie. And so I think there is a very feminine aspect to the way that the movie is directed. And I don't mean that in, you know, it's girly in some way. I think it's just very, it's very loving. And I just found the whole thing just an absolute delight.
So is it comedic in the sense of kind of like, you know, Three Men and a Baby, or, you know, like the beginning scenes of Kramer versus Kramer, you know, this whole thing of adult who doesn't know how to be a parent, or is it more like Florida Project, no, gritty, none of that?
None of the above.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
It's its own thing.
It's its okay. own sensibility. Wow. It's not gimmicky at all.
Yeah.
It's not trying to make a, you know, sitcom-y comedy out of it. It's not taking itself overly seriously like the Florida Project. It just literally follows this girl, you know, and this stranger who has to kind of, you know, be her ward over the next 3 days.
Okay.
And I completely agree with what Joe said, is that the movie lives and dies by that girl. And, you know, there's none of that precocious, too smart, too giggly. That, you know, that girl is not that. I mean, she has her stubbornnesses, she has her peculiarities, but she, that's what little girls are.
Okay.
And you know, she's in the movie the whole time, and they, you know, it's famously said that, you know, you shouldn't
never work with children,
never
and animals.
Work with small children or animals, and this movie is entirely, you know, with this little girl. And I should also say, the guy who plays, you know, her mom's ex-husband, he's like a scruffier, you know, shorter version of Domhnall Gleeson.
Oh.
And
I can see that, yeah.
And he, I don't know, there's a decency to all the characters in this movie. There are no villains in here. Everybody's trying to do their best. And I don't know, there's something very sunshiny about the movie. There's a warmth about it. There's a I don't know. It was just great company. I just loved watching the two of them. And like you said, by the end of those 3 days, over a period of 90 minutes, when it's time for the two to separate, I felt sadness for them because I believe that the two of them had formed a relationship, and that kind of stuff is very hard to do.
So I can't wait for this one to come
lovely,
and
lovely film.
Be accessed. So
yeah, lovely film.
Lovely.
It's terrific. And again, I think.
Oh, I heard my best. Yes, Steve, my best.
Yes.
You said my best.
My best for day three, for okay. sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's. The only other thing I was going to mention about the movie is it's so warm and delightful and just cuddly, a good time. So great. Let's move on then to the next movie, which I think Yazzie, you were the only one who saw this one, which was Adam and Satan. And as I flip to my description here in the show notes. So this was a documentary, and I think this one went head to head with the Studio 54, which is where Rashmi was, and I think I was at something else during that time. So this is part of the Viewpoint series here at the Tribeca Film Festival, and the description goes that one day in 1986, Adam Gusso, a white Ivy League educated harmonica player, found himself nursing a broken heart and walking down the street in Harlem, a block from the Apollo Theater. There he came upon a one-man blues band, Sterling McGee, better known as Satan. McGee was a local legend and heavy blues guitar riffs and makeshift percussion instrument. Word around the neighborhood was that he had backed James Brown at the Apollo and cut singles for Ray Charles' Tangerine label, but no one really knew for sure. So, again, this is directed by V. Scott Balsarek, and it's credited with a couple of screenwriting credits as well. It has obviously Sterling McGee and Adam Gusow as the, and I hope I'm saying those names correctly, as the main characters. So, Yazdi, tell us about Satan and Adam.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite something. It's the quintessential, I think, New York documentary, because it talks about these two very, very unlikely people who, you know, fate brought them together. And, you know,
like two people who have no reason to be together.
They have no reason to be together. Yeah. And the movie, you know, makes a very good point that, you know, this was happening, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, when New York was just completely separated by racial strife. And Harlem was a very dangerous place to be in. And it wasn't the kind of thing where, you know, there was nothing hipster about it. People were afraid to essentially go to Harlem. And this person, Adam, he had just come off a broken relationship, and he was kind of lost in life, and he didn't know what to do. And he didn't have much, you know, he was pursuing a different career, but he was an excellent harmonica player. And he just happened to, almost at risk of his life, happened to be walking along Harlem, and he saw this man who was playing the blues, and everybody in Harlem called him Satan. And, you know, he said that if there was one brave thing he did in his entire life, which kind of changed his whole life, it was he built up the courage in the middle of Harlem to being a... And he is not just a white dude. He's like blonde hair, right. You know, very Nordic looking man, who walked up to this blues singer on the side of the street and said, you know, do you mind if I play with you? And maybe out of pity, or maybe out of to see if this guy's going to make a joke of himself, this guy agreed to let him play a set with him. And then he came back the next, and he, you know, to his own surprise and everybody's surprise, you know, they were, you know, they did a great job. And then eventually he started playing more and more with them together. And then the rest of the movie kind of follows their life's progression and how each one landed up helping the other. Why Sterling McGee just chose to call himself Satan, and he had been he had played with James Brown and all these people, and he was reduced to playing on street corners, you know, in Harlem. And, you know, when he got older in life, and he, you know, he essentially lost the ability to play, you know, play the guitar. And there's this whole ebb and flow of the career of these two musicians when you realize how quintessential each one was for the other in creating the sound that they did. So it's a beautiful...
So is it archival footage that they
use? It's all archival footage.
Wow.
It's all archival footage.
Great.
And are they both still alive? And were they part of the filmmaking process?
Yeah, they were part. So they are both... So Sterling McGee has... you know, he has dementia now. This goes back a while. Adam, whatever his last name is, he is a talking head through most of the film, and you know, he continues through. It talks about race, it talks about appropriation of music. You know, what does it mean for a white dude to be part of a very, very, you know, quintessentially blues music? What is your responsibility towards another human being? It's pretty fascinating. I really enjoyed it. Definitely one to look out for.
Nice.
Terrific. Yeah. So that's and it's Satan just, and Adam. I was going to say, just to clarify, it's Satan and Adam, not Adam and Satan, as I had
wrote in the notes.
Well, I wasn't going to blame you for that, but given that you admitted to it.
My bad.
Rashmi's fault.
Mea culpa.
Okay, next movie
and
then.
I'm sorry, there's just so much that Sterling McGee says at different times, which just reads like life lessons, you know, about the
importance. This is probably like the true nature of wisdom, right? This is experiential stuff, like the kind of thing that you can only attain through maybe living and perhaps even hard living, right? It sounds like.
Right. It's beautiful. I mean, he talks about how one of the most important characteristics of success is to surrender. And if you try to decide what your tomorrow is going to be like, then that's you know, it's a completely wasted effort, because your tomorrow will not be how you planned it.
Right.
And the best you will do is to just surrender to what tomorrow is and make the most of it. So there's lots of, it sounds corny even as I'm saying it, but you know, it's a lovely film.
I'm increasingly of that opinion with life.
Yeah.
Great. Well, let's move on to the next movie, which is The American Meme. And I think, Yazdi, you're going to tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, The American Meme. And here's the notes from Tribeca. What's there to say? We are all familiar with The American Meme. There seems to be one popping up, every day, every other day on the internet. But here's the description. Ever since Paris Hilton first, by her own account, invented the selfie, did she really? Anyway, a generation of social media stars has emerged to bring their larger-than-life, bite-sized brands to the digital space. Millions of viewers subsist on a daily social media diet filled with the antics of the Fat Jew, Emily Ratajkowski, Brittany Ferlin, and Hilton herself, all of whom, through a seemingly endless stream of posts, allow the public into their everyday lives in a distinctly intimate manner. But sometimes, even the biggest social media stars have to turn off the cameras. So this one is directed by Bert Marcus, who also produced it along with Cassandra Hamar. And it has a cast of all the people I spoke about: Paris Hilton, DJ Khaled, Kirill Bichutsky, Emily Ratajkowski, Haley Baldwin, Josh Ostrowski. I presume these are social media stars. I don't know them, but I didn't see this. The both of you did. So tell us.
Well, before I'm actually very curious to see what Rashmi thought about this, because I could see I could see her in the corner of my eye having various visceral, almost physical reactions to much of what was going on here. So I'm kind of curious to see what you thought of this movie, Rashmi.
I hated this movie.
Well, no, did you hate the movie or the subject matter?
I was just going to say, well, let me qualify that by saying I hated the subject matter that it's covering. I think it's a very proficiently well-made movie. And if the desire of it is to turn us off from ever going on the internet and looking at these...
media whores.
Yeah, is the best way to describe them, then it absolutely achieved its goal. The thing I hated most about it was every single one of those talking heads came on and almost, and I don't know if this is just the editing, made us kind of almost cried for our sympathy. Yet they are the ones who are self-propagating this downward spiral of like filth. Maybe I'm just old. I felt very, very old as we walked out. I never want to ever look at Snapchat or these, you know, celeb realities again. I was completely turned off by the subject matter. In fact, I almost wanted to walk out. I was feeling sick with what I was seeing on the screen. So
yeah, so I was right.
Purpose achieved.
I was right. Rashmi was squirming because I looked at you, and I think had the lights been on in the theater, you would have been various different shades of color throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
So I mean, yeah, I think the movie shone a light onto, and it's interesting because I'm not a big Snapchat user. I can't figure it out. I'm over the age of 40, and I think anyone over the age of 20 is probably unable to figure out the interface for Snapchat. So I've never really used that, but I am a big fan of Instagram as kind of a medium. And it was amazing to me that these, you know, quote unquote stars on Instagram and social media were completely unknown to me. So again, I think I'm well out of it. It made me feel kind of very out of touch to begin with, because I'd never heard of Brittany Furlow and the Fat Jewish and
DJ Khaled.
I think I'd heard of DJ Khaled, but I hadn't heard of, you know, Kirill was here and
the slut whisperer is how he goes.
But I think the movie was very effective at kind of opening my eyes to a world that is clearly very influential to millennials, right? And I think it was shocking in the same way that I think, you know, our parents may have viewed our pop culture. You know, there's something very pornographic about the way that these guys, you know, go about, you know, whoring themselves out essentially over likes. But this has become, you know, a career for these guys. It's been very lucrative for them financially. And I think the movie shone that light in a way that I hadn't really understood before. I'm absolutely, utterly not a fan of reality TV in general. And to me, this is just an extreme version of that. You know, we had Paris Hilton, who was very much a big presence in the movie early on, because, you know, she set the ball rolling with TV shows like the Simple Life, where we had that kind of following around a celebrity. This idea of being famous for being famous, you know, came about with her. And I think with Instagram and various other social media programs, the potential to become famous for being famous has grown. So it shines that light on that world. I think the movie did definitely want to push buttons, because I think Instagram, for example, has a very famous no nipple rule. You know, there is no bare flesh on Instagram.
Oh, I wasn't that, aware of that.
I've seen pictures on Instagram that are very close to nudity, but they have a very strict no nudity rule. And so it was interesting to me that these people were as popular as they were on Instagram, given that the kind of things that are seen done, you know, this guy Kirill, I forget his last name, he became famous for basically pouring champagne over naked girls in nightclubs. You know, that's kind of his thing. Yeah. And so, you know,
I don't even want to talk about this.
Well, no, I think you know, my ultimate feeling was that the movie, I think, was pointing a very critical eye. And I think you say that these people were trying to make us feel sorry for them. I mean, I did in some kind of weird and twisted way, because ultimately, I think the lesson here is that, you know, they do this for adoration, and yet it's kind of empty calories, right? You know, this is the kind of thing that we hear about over and over again that's happened over generations. People who, you know, promote themselves are promoted and used by the world. The difference here is, I think, instead of corporation, you know, we hear about the boy bands, right? They're thrown out there, thrust into the world, and, you know, they have the, you know, infinite fans, and then no one wants them after, you know, they stop making hit singles. Well, you know, the difference there and between there and now is, instead of some corporation doing it, these people are doing it to themselves. And, you know, there isn't even the excuse that they've been exploited. They've exploited themselves. And so when they're used up kind of has-beens, it is a little harder to feel sympathy towards them. But again, I think that was the movie's point.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I think it's an effective documentary because it just makes you feel sickened that these people who literally whore themselves out and do disgusting things themselves and are just, you know, so desperate to become famous and have that adoration and be someone are actually people, 80% of them are broken people inside.
But hasn't that always been the case?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, think about, you know, people
over. What I'm saying is that they've, you know, it's not like they've created a song in a boy band or created, been in a movie. These are people who are literally doing ridiculous things like pouring champagne over, you know, naked women's bodies and taking little video clips of them and putting them on the internet or doing something stupid. Anyway.
But this is the inevitable path that reality TV takes us on. And I think, you know, it's really just an extension of things that we see on TV. You know, I'm going to pick on The Real Housewives because I find that show to be tragic. But the way that you felt about this movie is very much the way that I feel about things like, you know, the Real Housewives and those various kind of horribly produced reality shows that have become so pervasive, right? These are people who aren't special in any way, seemingly, that are thrust in front of us.
They're actually unspecial. That's
Kardashians, all of that kind of thing. I mean, you know, so to me, I think it is worth definitely your time watching, if only to get the visceral kind of reaction to, you know, because I think there's something to be learned here. And I think the movie achieves its objective in that
point.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think they're telling about us as a society as uncomfortable as it is, because these are self-appointed.
Correct.
Yep. Nobody picked them. It's by the number of likes and the number of, you know, people who support these celebrity stars that their cachet rises. And so it says a lot about us. So I look forward to cringe and watch it sometime.
It's very effective. I think it definitely, if its mission was to create a response, I think... It definitely did that.
Mission accomplished.
And I think the filmmaking was actually very, very well done. It was very crafted. It told the story in a way that was very effective. It gave us a peek at what these people are really like as well. Not just the personas, but the people behind them. So I thought this was great. Just difficult. and definitely not one for the kids. That's all I'll say there. Okay, let's move on to the next movie the final one that we're going to cover in this podcast, which is somewhat apt in that this was probably, Rashmi, your second most anticipated movie of the whole film festival, I think.
Because
the writer-director, or rather, yeah, the part writer and whole director, Haifa Al-Mansour, was the director of a movie made a couple of years ago. I think it's available on Netflix. I know it was for a time, a movie called Wajda. She was the first female, it was the first movie ever directed by a female director to come out of Saudi Arabia. And so, you know, it came
Made
in Saudi Arabia. And it came with some, you know, fanfare simply because of that fact. But it also turned out to be an absolutely wonderful little movie that... we, I think, unanimously have enjoyed on Movie Wallace. Rashmi, I know you're a big fan of it. So, the director had secured her next job, which was also about a very independent female character, Mary Shelley, of Frankenstein authorship fame. So she has done what is effectively a kind of a biographical pick on Mary Shelley, who in this instance is played by Elle Fanning. The movie also includes Douglas Booth, Belle Powley, Tom Sturridge, and Maisie Williams. And the premise here is it picks up the story of Mary Shelley from kind of a young age and takes us through some of the events of her life that she had in growing up in terms of her relationships, the trials and tribulations of her parental home and her relationship with her stepmother, on into kind of her romance, and then ultimately the events that culminated in the authoring of the very famous novel Frankenstein. So I guess we all three saw this one, and Haifa Al-Mansour was also at the premiere, which was lovely to see. So guys, what did you think of Mary Shelley?
This is a perfectly serviceable, historical retelling of, Mary Shelley. It's serviceable, but I can't be any more charitable than that. It kind of plays like one of those Sunday night KPBS shows. It's really, Frankenstein endures even now is one of the great horror creations of all time. And it obviously came from the mind of somebody who, whose brain had the capacity to think that up. And I don't know if it's the casting of Elle Fanning or the entirely declawed approach to the whole story that it just comes across as tepid and silly and just very tame. I just found the whole enterprise tame to the point of being boring. And this is a good cast of characters. These are there's nothing wrong with any of them, but it almost seems like they made an omelet without breaking the egg. They were too scared to break the egg.
Oh, I love that.
So it was so bizarre. And my mind kept going back to this movie which came out, gosh, in the mid 80s with exactly the same characters and the great provocateur director Ken Russell made this movie called Gothic, and it had Natasha Richardson, Liam Neeson's wife who tragically died. It had Julian Sands and other people, and that movie was so wonderfully over the top and nasty and bloody, and you could get a sense of how somebody went, what circumstances might have led somebody to become so deranged that they would write something like Frankenstein. And this movie kind of instead completely ignores that and becomes this weird love story between Byron and Shelley. So I don't know where they were going at. Maybe that is the truth, but as a movie-going experience, it came across as very lukewarm tea. I felt like that the whole movie should be put in a microwave and heated up a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, beginning of this segment, I really love and respect Haifa Al-Mansour. I actually saw her speak at this huge conference called the Milken Institute last year in LA as well. And she was equally impressive there as we had seen her at LA Film Festival the years before when we had watched Wajda. So rather like Frankenstein, I found this to be lifeless. This came off more like an HBO Showtime special that could have been split. Yeah, I think, I've watched some of those really bad miniseries, not as good as The Tudors, but in that same vein. And this is how that felt. I think it was toothless, and I found like it was just this bunch of teenage kids running around, and I couldn't take it seriously when the story has so much heft. And there's a lot to explore, and I do like what she was trying to do in terms of creating this character in Mary Shelley, who wanted to go against the norms and break the rules and live her life as she wanted to live her life. We've seen Belle Powley do great acting in Diary of a Teenage Girl. Maisie Williams is from Game of Thrones. I mean, this is the little spitfire who is, Arya, one of the main characters on Game of Thrones, and, yields a sword. So I kind of understand what she was trying to do, but it just didn't get there. I was really, really disappointed.
Yeah, I think this movie, this is a story that cannot be told with a conservative viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
You have to, like Yazdi was saying, it has to bear it all, right? Because we have, a lot of implied sex and sexuality, and these people were very kind of avant-garde in their relationships. They were bucking convention and tradition in terms of expectations of of the times. I mean, this was the 1800s,
right.
And we had a very conservative society,
right.
and they were saying, we should challenge what marriage is and challenge what love and how love can be between people.
I mean, this
is
exploring pansexuality.
Right, and so for a movie that, barely you know, reveals a calf, never mind, more flesh. And this needed to be tawdry. And I think whatever the decisions behind the movie, it was not the right approach to use to tell this story, because I think it is a very interesting story. I don't think the cast are at fault here. I think the cast did really well with what they had. You know, Elle Fanning, you know, could you know, read the side of a you know, soap powder box, and I think it would be compelling viewing. So I think, you know, they're not necessarily at fault for what happened here, but definitely whether it was the director's choice, whether it was studio interference, but somebody has rubbed off all the edges, and unfortunately that's what this movie needed. So yeah, I felt kind of disappointed too. With that said, I did get through it. I mean, it did feel very Lifetime to me. You know, it was kind of an interesting kind of biopic, and I think there are aspects of the story that still stay with me after the movie went away. I didn't know what went into the mind of Mary Shelley as she came up with the Frankenstein character. But, you know, I think we needed more direct references, you know, what, you know, the pain, for example, the major source of pain that she has as a character was almost edited out of the movie. I mean, you know, we had them disappear off into a rainstorm, and then there's a major plot device, which I didn't actually understand had happened until a couple of minutes later, when I was like, wait a second, you know, where is this thing?
And even look, the portrayal of Byron, I mean, Byron is a revered, important poet of our time, not of our time, but of time. And, you know, I just read one of the other reviews that has come up. I mean, it's true, and I agree with that review. He came off a bit Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
Right, rather than Lord Byron. I mean, where was the poetry?
Yeah, and I think I this must have been intentional, because they've got to know this 1986 movie which came out, Gothic, which was exactly about this. But maybe they were thinking that movie was too tawdry, and there is a simpler, you know, gentler movie to be made about this. And maybe there is, but they shouldn't have gone with these teen actors. I think they should have gone with, like, Mary Shelley, by the time she got to write Frankenstein, had lived her life. I think you need a lived-in actor.
Yeah.
Somebody whose face looks like...
Weathered.
And they've, you know, someone like, even in, you know, Susan Sarandon or Nicole Kidman. I won't even suggest who it is. You could go with younger actors. But not Elle Fanning. Elle Fanning looks like she's, you know...
An angel.
At a party. Or she looks like an angel, you know, so...
It looked a bit like they're all playing dress-up.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know much about the production of this movie, but I think the fact that it was still filmed over several countries, and if you look at the number of logos at the beginning of the movie, Rashmi, you actually commented when the movie was opening...
I did.
...that, you know, there were several companies involved in the financing of this movie, and I feel like the risk that they were taking, they thought that they should make a movie that might have broader appeal.
Yeah.
You know, not even the PG-13 version of this, the kind of, you know, E for Everyone type rating was what they thought maybe they could get away with here, and this needs to be an NC-17.
It totally doesn't.
It's not even that. It just needs to have more guts. It needs to have more depth. It needs to have more heft. Right? I mean, this is the person who wrote Frankenstein. Yes, you said it really, really articulately.
And, you know, the pathology. Why would somebody decide to do this? You know, and it kind of, it's there in the dialogue, you know, how completely maverick these characters were. You know, they went completely against society. But did I believe them? No, I did not. And I don't know. I mean, who is this movie for? Is it for history, you know, buffs? Maybe. Is it for people who are into Frankenstein? Because they are going to walk away from this movie saying, what the hell? There's nothing scarier. There's nothing to be gleaned about Frankenstein. So then, I don't know. Who is the target?
It's not a teenage crowd. It's not a teenage crowd.
I know exactly where it's for.
Too spicy for that.
I know exactly where.
Is it for the landmark crowd?
I don't think this was intended for them, but I can absolutely see this being part of your curriculum in high school.
Oh dear!
You know, remember those TV shows that they would show you to tell about literature that were kind of awful and made for that purpose? It felt very much like that. So, ugh. Unfortunately, yeah, not a hit for us. But you know, with that said,
everyone's allowed one failure.
And yes, you know, if this was on TV, I wouldn't change channel. So I just want to kind of correct the impression that I had here. I think
great
this
costume,
is
great production.
Yeah, great production design, and great you can't fault the actors; they're all fine. I think it's just the treatment to the material, of the materials.
I hold the script entirely responsible for what we ended up with. Yeah. Oh, well, too bad. Okay, so unfortunately we didn't end on a high note on this podcast, but we'll be back again with a podcast very shortly to give us give you our wrap-up of Tribeca. So until our next podcast, way too many movies, too little time. A goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.